Kessler, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today we'll be discussing controversial aspects of 9/11 research with Morgan Reynolds, Chief Economist, Department of Labor under George W. Bush in 2001 and 2002, former director of the Criminal Justice Center at the National Center for Policy Analysis, and Professor Emeritus, Texas A&M University. Morgan has a website at nomoregames.net, which I encourage you to read. He has a tremendous capacity to make powerful points in clear language, and today we're going to talk about a wide range of issues, including the destruction of the Twin Towers and its method of demolition, and the nature of the planes or not that were involved at on 9/11 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and in the Pentagon, and especially and most controversially at the World Trade Center. Morgan, it's a great pleasure to welcome you on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Jim.
You know, I had this very surreal experience in a way out at Chandler, where I was engaged in a discussion with Steve Jones about the science of 9/11 research and was explaining why I take some exception to some of his work. And he was responding to most of the points I was making, which I was illustrating with slides, and which is now available on our website. If you go to 23 to 25 February, you'll find that you can everyone can view this exchange. And I offered quite a lot of evidence there, but he mostly responded by directing everyone to some letters section of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which he, of course, originally founded with Judy Wood as his co-editor, and actually I was the managing editor initially, but then he reworked it, and now he's doing the journal with Kevin Ryan. But there are lots of oddities about the journal, including that it seems to be not so much devoted to original research as attacking positions that people don't hold. I mean, one of the oddities about his whole approach was attributing to you and Judy especially, perhaps very specific hypotheses, which, to the best of my knowledge, neither of you have actually advanced in all of your efforts to broaden consideration of the range of evidence that has to be explained, a point I was making. And among my efforts to suggest why he might want to rethink some of his work is that the very title of his paper, Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Completely Collapse, as I observed then, is very misleading in two respects. One, they didn't collapse. I mean, Building 7 came down in a classic controlled demolition. But in your memorable phrase, the Twin Towers were blown to kingdom come. They were pulverized. And that's the second problem. He says World Trade Center buildings, as though this were encompassing World Trade Center 3, 4, 5, and 6, about which he has nothing to say. And I was also troubled and suggested that he might want to consider revising his abstract, which suggests that we should have a reinvestigation based on whether cutter charges might have been used to bring the buildings down. But, of course, cutter charges would only leave the rest of the buildings collapse, in that case, to gravitational attraction. So it seems to me there are major problems here. And when I addressed it all at the very end, I explained, I asserted that, in my opinion, thermite couldn't do it. And he called out from his seat, prove it, as though the burden of proof here, as though I hadn't been laying out all the evidence that he needed to explain and outline why, in my judgment, thermite couldn't do it, but also shifting the burden of proof. I mean, it seems to me, and I'd like your opinion about this, that he's never really demonstrated that his preferred hypothesis could possibly do the job.
Well, I agree with all of the above. Your first point about the terminology collapse, now we've all been guilty of that, present company included. It seems hard to avoid that the buildings come down and everybody calls it almost unthinkingly a collapse. But at this point, Stephen and everyone else ought to correct themselves. And his failure to do so shows either stupidity or bad intentions. In other words, the intent to mislead. And yes, I've been credited, I think, properly with the use of the phrase blown to kingdom come. And when you see these twin towers go the way they do from top to bottom, turning to dust, the snowball, as Judy Wood calls it, et cetera. It's just we got to discipline ourselves, and Stephen won't adjust. Regarding buildings 3, 4, 5, and 6, yeah, to the best of my knowledge, Stephen Jones has done nothing serious to explain the damage there. Of course, portions of these buildings, almost none of the main part of 4 was left, and most of 3 was gone. That was the Marriott Hotel, a 22-story building right next to the South Tower. And all these mysterious holes, which I'd known about some time ago, but just put on the back burner as, gee, what could explain that? So I've been helping Judy, as you know, on the so-called Star Wars beam weapon or directed energy weapon paper. And we're the only ones I know who've made a... It, just to fob it off on falling thermite or steel beams is completely inadequate to explain the data here.
Well, it seems to me he has a slogan, not an explanation, and that there are a lot of things he's doing here that raise questions in my mind. He is willing to make revisions when he thinks they're called for. For example, among the various points I made were that his research depends heavily on a set of photographs whose authenticity there may be reason to suspect. One is, of course, this flowing metal, whatever, from the building, because in some photographs it's coming out of the third notch of the South Tower, in others the fourth, and while they're not at the same time, it raises questions about whether or not those could have been faked. I always thought those photographs looked very odd right mm-hmm. from scratch. We have other photographs of the apparent use of thermite cleaning up, which obviously could contaminate the data and provide an explanation for why you might find thermite or thermate residues among the debris without it being the case that it was used to bring down the tower, although that, of course, possibility isn't one that you or I or Judy would exclude as a partial explanation, that it might have been used to bring down some of the floors. But then you have a backhoe holding this slag of what is, you know, extremely hot metal. And as Judy has pointed out to me, I mean, steel being such a good thermal conductor that it would, in expanding when it's heated, she doubts very much that the hydraulics could operate
mm-hmm.
under those conditions. And most fascinating, you have this group of workers, Morgan, peering into a, you know, a kind of subterranean cavern that's just aglow with molten metal. Well, I drew the parallel in Chandler with a tea kettle. You know, when it starts to whistle, are you going to open up the spout and put your face over it? Obviously not. Your face would be steamed. You'd be burned. Well, here we're talking at there we got a temperature of around 212 degrees. Here we're talking about a temperature around 3,000 degrees. If this is truly molten metal, surely the flesh would be burning off of their faces. So what have I discovered now is that he has that photograph. In fact, all three of those I described were in his paper, the very paper we're talking about, Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Completely Collapse? And now he's taken out that photograph of the group peering into the underground.
He's got too much heat.
And substituted another photograph. So he's willing to make revisions when it's called for. But
that was a fake. That proves it was a fake.
Don't you think, Morgan? Isn't this rather striking? Rather than defending it, he simply took it out?
Right. In this day and age, you got to be very careful about photos and videos because of the ease of manipulating them.
And I wonder if he had it peer-reviewed again. I'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you could catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, a Republican who has seen the light about 9/11 and minced no bones, has been very outspoken about it, including giving a magnificent lecture here in Madison, Wisconsin. Morgan, I just want to say a few more words about this business. Something that struck me in Chandler was how Steve has his conception of science is not only focusing on a single hypothesis, as though you could show that a hypothesis is better than the alternatives without comparing it to the alternatives, but placing emphasis on peer review. when he should be placing emphasis on replication. Peer review, obviously, is a matter of getting a consensus among, you know, the group of individuals who review a paper, but that doesn't show that their judgment is good judgment unless, of course, they're highly competent and qualified to review. For example, it came out that another speaker on our session was Carl Weiss, who designed the logo for Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It's a wonderful logo, as befits his background in art, which is his discipline. He retired as an associate professor of art. But what stunned me to be reminded of this is that he served as a referee on the paper that you had submitted about whether or not, you know, what had hit the World Trade Center. And I can't imagine a less, you know, inappropriate person. I mean, he had just didn't have the background for it. So, I mean, that seems to me to be an example of peer review really being perfunctory and based on an unqualified judgment.
I'd make a more general point that does not reflect well on Professor Jones, and that is he is trading in all the trappings of academe and the physical sciences, but not the substance. So there's a great deal of resort to authority. I saw his talk at the session you're referring to out on Chandler, Arizona, and it's almost a bulletin board for, oh, it's see this paper, see that paper.
Yeah.
So where's the beef?
Yes.
He doesn't have sharp-edged hypotheses compared to each other and then a clear look at the data to see what works, what doesn't, which is supported, which is disconfirmed. In other words, to me, this is a show that leads into a cul-de-sac, a kind of a dead end, inconclusive. Even if you were, let's grant, Jim, Stephen Jones proves up thermite was at the World Trade Center and was part of the elements that destroyed the Twin Towers. Well, yawn. So what? It certainly doesn't explain all of the events at the World Trade Center.
It certainly doesn't. And he has offered no evidence that it could have brought them down, if you wanted to use that phrase, destroyed them the way they were destroyed in the amount of time, approximately 10 seconds apiece, or with the degree of pulverization. I asked him a question in the lobby out in Los Angeles at the end of the American Scholars Conference on Sunday, it must have been, the 25th of June, whether he thought that this super thermite he was talking about could bring about the degree of pulverization of the building. I just wanted to have a direct statement from him about it, and he assured me, oh, yes, it could. But so far as I know, we actually don't even have evidence that superthermite, such as it may be, even existed in 2001, much less that it could perform the miracles you would attribute to it.
Yeah, to me it's very frustrating. And his bottom line, of course, he spends a lot of time playing to the gallery.
Yes.
With his baby face and his giggle, and, you know, my nice uncle wouldn't mislead me. He could. Think about what his bottom line is. He calls for a new investigation of his thermite hypothesis. Well, how narrow and soft is that? We're going to have the government investigate itself another time? We need prosecution. We've got plenty to begin arresting people and indicting them. And we have so many facts that have no other explanation but that the accused did it. And you need to start unraveling this entire conspiracy, and the whole country needs to reexamine itself from the ground up.
Well, I begin to think that everything is smoke and mirrors, you know, and I'm troubled when I offer, you know, very specific examples. I had over 45 slides, Morgan, in my presentation, and they were all of evidence or of calculations related to the evidence. Judy's calculations about converting, say, if all the material in the towers were 10% mm-hmm. of their volume, how much dust mm-hmm. would turn out, or 5%, and so forth, and how the evidence tended to confirm that, and the massive coverage of Lower Manhattan with dust, and these photographs or images of these asteroids that are in Building 17, Hangar 17 out at JFK, and how the future fusing together the floors and all that required, you know, incredibly high temperatures. And I offered some information about plasma as opposed to thermate and why plasma generates tens of thousands of degrees and thermate only thousands, and how plasma could bring about the molecular dissociation, but there's no such mechanism on behalf of thermate and so forth. And it troubles me, too, just as you say, this appeal to authority. Here's one paper, this Gregory Jenkins, who performed this hip video on Judy, which I found highly objectionable at the time, begins, and I find this quite an affront, with a quote from me from an interview on the Dynamic Duo, where I said, in fact, the whole interview with Greg Jenkins was very troublesome to me because it was so clear that he was seeking to put words in Judy's mouth and demand an exactitude of answers that she was going to be unable to provide, dot, dot, dot. Dr. James Fetzer, during the Dynamic Duo radio broadcast in 2607 regarding an interview conducted at the National Press Club, and then he gives a citation to his video. And then he begins by saying the actual paper is, Dr. James Fetzer suggests Dr. Judy Witt may be unable to provide answers to basic questions regarding her own speculative hypothesis. But he cut off the rest of my sentence. I said that she's going to be unable to provide because he's attributing to her a very specific hypothesis that she hasn't advanced. So he completely inverted the meaning by editing the last part of the sentence. Now, that's disgusting. That's unscrupulous, and that's dishonest. That is not good science.
Lying.
And if this paper had been peer-reviewed, how could you get past the prefatory note at the top in the first sentence of the paper? I mean, this is not responsible. It's not respectable. It's garbage.
Well, nobody can dispute legitimately that it was an ambush interview, because he comes out with all this work now, this 30-page paper in the journal that's a hit piece on Judy and my work, and he's been on a chat board or forum, Judy, and I've seen it, trying to wheedle out the so-called scandalous stories about Judy down there at Clemson. So the guy is a complete limeball.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. I'm your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, and we're talking about 9/11 research. Morgan, just for the benefit of our audience, when you mention Steve's manner, you know, his appearance and his giggle and so forth, I of course appreciate that you're talking about a stylistic aspect because it has an effect on the audience, of kind of lulling them into being uncritical about what he says. You're not saying that because he has those mannerisms, therefore what he's saying is false, but rather that it's just a manner or style he has that makes it rather easy for an audience to be less critical about what he is pronouncing than they might otherwise be.
Right. I called it a psyop technique. Now, this may be why Stephen reappeared, after the cold fusion problem, right?
Yeah.
Played a similar role there in 1989 in squashing the Pons-Fleischmann work, which conceivably in reality can lead to something close to free energy, and the whole energy establishment jumped on that and helped seriously by Stephen Jones. So I think we need to be on alert here.
And that was kind of like a shell game, as I understand it. I mean, I'm reminded of how the federal attorneys in Arlington, when they were trying Zacharias Moussaoui for his penalty, treated him as though he pleaded guilty to involvement in the events of 9/11 when he'd actually pled guilty a year before to involvement in a completely different plot. I mean, it was a shell game. Now, as I understand it, what Jones showed was that a different method than Pons and Fleischmann would not produce much energy, that the actual method they were using was at fault.
That's what I understand, too. And I'm no expert, but I've delved into that a little bit. And there's quite a good cold fusion video online that I can't give you an address for right off, but I'd urge people to look for that.
Something that troubled me, too, was Peter Dale Scott, whom I greatly admire, asked a question after hearing Steve Jones refer to a whole lot of written responses to you and to Judy that were clearly attempts to refute very specific versions that were being of hypotheses that were being attributed to you, to the best of my knowledge, none of which have you actually embraced. And he was asking whether I could commit you or even me to writing written responses to them. And, you know, I explained, of course, that I wasn't in the position to commit you to doing that, but it strikes me that I might very well have pointed out that previous to all of this, you and Judy had written very nice critiques, very thorough, painstaking of his work, to which, to the best of my knowledge, he has never responded. So that I think Peter Dale Scott may have simply been lacking information about the state of play of this research.
Yeah, we we've seen the video where this session went down with you and Steve and Kevin, and I heard Peter Dale Scott ask that question. I recognized his voice of the audience, so we wrote to him via an email and pointed out a number of things, including if the work of Reynolds and Wood is so all-fired important, why didn't they invite us? We were happy to defend our work in any forum, but on the other hand, we can't be taking all of our time and energy and fighting off all these gnats. Steve has got his own little platoon devoted to attacks. 10 of the last 11 articles in his journal, really a website, are attacks on Judy and my work or Judy's work. So this is not well intended to correct our work, because most of it is fallacious nonsense. If you look at our paper, you will find all of these things are preempted already in the paper by and large. So we're not getting anything useful out of their attacks, that's for sure. And we've got some friends who are responding and helping us. So our agenda is not going to be driven by Stephen Jones.
Yeah, I think that's completely appropriate. I mean, and he has shown himself perfectly willing to embrace positions and statements by others that are not fair or even-handed. Here's one where he has this piece about what are the goals of the 9/11 truth community, and he begins by talking about a statement from Frank Leggy, Kevin Ryan, Victoria Ashley, and others. And he says, on the scholar's site, positions are being promoted, which are disputed by the scientists specializing in the physical sciences from Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Attempts to correct the situation have failed. Well, what position by anyone in relation to these issues is not disputed? Judy, in my judgment, has the best qualifications of anyone involved in this research. They're far superior and more specific to the issues involved than those of an archaeometrist and a scientist related to cold fusion. So it seems to me that Steve's credentials are, in fact, less weighty than Judy's, and she's disputing his. So I think if we were to employ this standard even-handedly, if we're not supposed to even mention positions that are being disputed, then none of Steve's work ought to be cited anywhere or presented anywhere, not to mention the fact that saying the positions are being promoted was presumptuous, because my efforts here and this whole to-do broke out after I had Judy on my program on the 11th of November when I was out in Tucson, my last interview on Republic Broadcasting Network, talking about, you know, all the research you guys had been putting together about the vast damage to the World Trade Center building 6, 5, 4, 3, the fact that the bathtub was functionally intact even though it had suffered some damage, in the 1,400 toasted cars. That to me was such a spectacular development that I repeatedly referred to it as fascinating, because it showed that what we have to explain is so much more vast than just the Twin Towers and Building 7.
Yeah, and I want to go back to one point you made and second it, and that is Stephen's got to live, when he preaches to us, he's got to live by the same standard. And so, for example, we put out a couple of very weighty peer review of Stephen Jones' work back in August, September. And he had a perfunctory, a desultory initial reply that petered out quickly. It was only a couple pages that just responded to a couple of points and a couple of others that weren't in these critiques. So why doesn't he answer the critics, who were certainly his peers, as he preaches that we're supposed to be answering all these critics that he is cultivating on his website.
Yeah, and if you're going to count on peer review, and if your peers, you know, if the ones you're calling peers aren't really qualified, you know, as I would suggest is the case for Carl Weiss, even though I think he's a super smart guy, I mean, you really should be falling back on replicability. If we're going to impose the same standards on our own research that we're imposing on NIST, for example, we are faulting them for not having conducted a computer simulation. And I certainly remember saying that, but maybe my recollection is faulty. I certainly meant to say it during that session, but I say it here. I mean, Steve Jones, if he claims to have an explanation using thermite and thermate that could account for the phenomena that we observe, the dustification, the 10-second destruction, the failure to damage the bathtub so that it was functionally incapable of withholding the Hudson River water, let him do it. He has issued, it seems to me, a series of blank checks, promissory notes. He has used the word thermite, thermate over and over again, and I think we're all willing to say thermite, thermate may have been used in the beginning to initiate the destruction sequence so it wouldn't be so obvious if others, say, high-tech or directed energy or other weapons were involved, and maybe at the end to make sure there was some residue so it wouldn't be so completely obvious that something like 80% of the mass of these 500,000-ton buildings had been turned into very fine dust. Stand by. We're going to be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, today with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, and we're discussing some controversial aspects of 9/11 research. Morgan, before we turn to other subjects, I'd just like to point out that I'm becoming increasingly drawn to the notion that a plasma weapon might have been involved here because it operates or generates tens of thousands of degrees of heat as opposed to thermite only thousands of degrees, that it can account for the molecular dissociation that produced all those tiny, tiny particles in the dust, many of which, of course, went into the upper atmosphere rather than downward. I mean, Steve's samples of dust have kind of stunned me because I've discovered several very extensive studies of the dust that preceded his. One here dated 27 November 2001, environmental studies of the World Trade Center area after the September 11, 2001 attack. It seems very thorough and extensive. Here's another open file report, 01-0429, World Trade Center USGS bulk chemistry results. Again, this looks very thoroughgoing. And I'm just kind of puzzled how, you know, Steve, I mean, this is difficult to believe, but he's actually got in his presentation a diagram that is of the World Trade Center and an arrow that shows the dust going from around the 80th floor into this woman's apartment. I mean, that's rather stupefying to me.
I haven't seen that.
Morgan?
Yes.
Isn't that stunning? I mean, it seems to me to be, you know, source non-specific. How in goodness gracious can you track dust like that in terms of its specific origin?
It's almost like economics, where if it doesn't have a lot of equations and diagrams, hopefully 3D, it's just not economic science. You know, it's just the trappings of analytical work. It's not the heart of it.
I wonder, you know, how many in his audience are taken in by a drawing like that, as though he actually...
That's the whole deal about the flummoxing the baboozy, as H.L. Mencken might put it, right? You're going to fool a number of people. But let me comment on your favorite leaning toward the plasma weapon.
Yeah.
What Judy Wood likes to say is, hey, we don't have the serial number. We're not, that's rushing this a little. Now, maybe we'll get it narrowed down, but the evidence does point to a beam weapon of some kind, and that's all the further I'm willing to go at this point. And then regarding the dust, I believe it was Professor Thomas Cahill of UC Davis has this study. I don't know. I think it's mainly the same location with eight monitoring instruments, but that seemed to be pretty impressive. And what really is at issue here is, amazingly enough, Stephen seems to insist that the dust is coarse, contrary to all the evidence, and even denying the enormous pulverization.
Well, this is so silly, Morgan. I mean, heavier dust settles. He took a sample that was settled dust. The vast majority of that very tiny dust was dispersed high up in the atmosphere. I mean, I showed a photograph that enveloped all of lower Manhattan in a gigantic cloud of dust. Is he
out in the bay?
That cloud of dust represents the pulverization, the dustification of some fantastic quantity of material?
Absolutely. And we have these distance shots from across the bay, roughly at the Statue of Liberty. And you can see it wafting along the Queens and out into the bay. And then, of course, the next day we get these satellite images where the wind is blowing to the southwest. Enormous material still going down the east coast, the eastern seaboard. And, of course, the New York Times in articles points out that the dust was as much as 3 inches deep in some locations. So the calculations in our dissertation, I call it, are spot on.
Yeah.
That's where most of the towers are.
And if you talk about the dust, of course, there's this incredibly volcanic-like heat pyroclastic cloud that is an unavoidable consequence of plasma, but so far as I can see, it can't be accounted for using thermite or thermate. In fact, he can't even explain the pulverization on thermite because it's a focused cutting mechanism, an incendiary. He appeals to super thermite, which has a completely different mode of operation if his hypothesis bears any water, but I can't imagine what it would be, and to my knowledge, he's never demonstrated it.
Yeah, which is it? Is it pulverization, explosions, or is it cutting, steel cutter? Yeah, you can't have both in the same mechanism. You know, you get that radial shock waves to explode things.
Of course, I've been troubled by Steve's conception of scientific method from the beginning because it's hopelessly inadequate insofar as it begins with observation. We make hundreds of observations all the time, and they don't lead to puzzlement, a phenomenon that requires explanation for us to sort out.
Well,
by focusing on single hypotheses, he leaves the impression that, in fact, hypothesis at a time is enough, and that we could decide that his thermite hypothesis is okay without comparing it with the alternatives. Just one final remark about the fact that neither you nor Judy is specifically committed to a mechanism. A point you were making, I think, is very, very appropriate. So I don't want to suggest overly specific, but plasma seems to me to one fascinating example. Just in transiting to what we want to talk about, Morgan, this last week has been fascinating for the degree of duplicity of the media here. We found out of the archives a BBC report of the destruction of World Trade Center 7 was put on the air broadcast at 4:57 when the building actually only collapsed at 5:20. It leads you to wonder whether anything that we're receiving, even through the media, even through the BBC, for example, can be trusted.
Well, it can't. My premise is you believe nothing that is remotely suspicious that comes from a government or its state-run media. It's virtually state-run. And you start from the other end. You disbelieve until you can independently verify and prove to the contrary or in support of the mainstream belief. My rule is if it's controversial, the fringe is right and the mainstream's wrong.
Well, you know, when it comes to this business about directed energy and so forth, of course, others have actually entertained the hypothesis. Webster Tarpley talks about Jim Hoffman having an early conjecture about directed energy and how Ken Jenkins has suggested that there's a problem in delivering it if it were delivered in the form of conventional electricity, which I think is probably a misconception. I mean, certainly it's not a necessary condition that it be delivered in the form of electricity. But it's led me to think about work of an earlier figure who I think is maybe someone we need to return to, namely Jeff King, who is an MIT engineer. If anyone goes and visits, for example, 9/11 Revisited, the DVD, you'll find not only that Jeff talks about demolition there, And in other places, he talks about a closely related issue about planes possibly not having been involved in the World Trade Center. And, of course, those are closely related because if there were no planes, obviously the planes had nothing to do with it. The planes actually can't have brought about the kinds of effects being attributed to them in any case. So in a way, you know, the planes can be factored out in terms of as irrelevant but spectacularly psychologically crucial if you want to create a phenomenal shock and awe impression upon a population that's susceptible, very gullible to anything it sees on television.
Jeff King and Jim Hoffman were early on this, the enormous amount of energy that destroyed the Twin Towers, and Jeff just labels it black technology. He doesn't want to call it some high heat weapon because it doesn't look like a high heat weapon really was the issue. It didn't fry human beings, etc. But I guess we'll come back to
indeed we will.
More.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host of the Dynamic Duo. We'll return shortly with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today, my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, and I are discussing some of the more controversial aspects of 9/11 research. In the first instance, we're talking about the possible modes of of causation that might have brought about the destruction, the pulverization of the Twin Towers, where about 80% of the mass appears to have been converted into very fine dust, a phenomenon that appears to be inexplicable on the hypothesis that thermite or thermate were involved. And even if you bring in conventional explosives like RDX, as Steve has proposed, I pointed out at the conference that RDX has chemical tags that allow you to identify its residue from its residue, its source or origin of manufacture, and that no such identifying chemical particulates have been identified here, which means that it's a gratuitous hypothesis for him to toss in RDX. Now, maybe some other conventional explosive may have been involved, but I can hardly imagine how they could possibly have brought about dust of the kind and character that was involved here, that ordinary dust from ordinary explosives is going to settle out of the atmosphere relatively rapidly. It's not going to display the characteristics of this massive cloud of dust that enveloped all of lower Manhattan. So that seems to me highly implausible. And as far as super thermate is concerned, I just got to say, you know, it's like, show me the money. Well, you know, give me the cash benefit. Give me the super thermate whole nine yards, which in my judgment manifestly has not occurred here. Now, the reason I like Jeff King, Morgan, so much in this context is not only is he eminently qualified, but he's addressing both the issue of the motive of destruction of the Twin Towers, where just from reviewing his clips today, he's talking about some kind of directed energy. And secondly, he's also talking about whether or not planes were involved in hitting the Twin Towers. Now, the thing about this is he hasn't been involved in any of the disputes that have arisen of late about either of these issues. He's eminently qualified. He's going to satisfy any criteria that Steve Jones and his clique would like to impose upon somebody that they're going to find credible. And he's saying things that are very much sympathetic or consistent with what you and Judy have been saying. So I want to invite our audience to go to 911scholars.org, scroll down to the events category for 28 February, and there you'll find not only do we have some links to some papers we're going to talk about now, but there is a Jeff King, an MIT engineer from 9/11 Revisited, two links there, one about his observations about demolition, another his observations about the planes. And what I was struck by his observation there, Morgan, is a point that you have made many times, namely the planes are made out of aluminum. They're like a flying beer can. And when they hit steel, you know, there's quite a difference in the properties of steel and the properties of aluminum. Now, it's, of course, the case that this aluminum beer can is traveling very fast, and therefore it has additional momentum by virtue of its velocity. But I wonder if you'd like to pick up there. I mean, Jeff King is already, some time back, offering reflections that suggest to him that the aircraft scenario may be seriously flawed. And since this is, you know, maybe like the most important topic for us to kick around at this point in time, especially because so many in our audience are going to be bewildered by the very idea the very possibility that it might not have happened the way they think they have observed it to happen in all these videos. I'd just like you to pick up there and tell us how we should understand what was going on.
Yeah, let me try to set the table here, though, first in terms of why this is so vital. Of course, hundreds of millions of people know that planes crashed, and a lot of them believe that it was all at these four designated sites. And the most important, of course, is the televised, what I believe was special effects, hit on the South Tower. Now, you pointed to this reporter who prematurely stands in front of the World Trade Center Building 7 and says it's collapsed. Well, it didn't happen until 23 minutes later. We know, that's just one of the many ways we know the big media, the corporate media, the controlled media are in on it. And the most important part of it was to sell the whole plane story. Now, why are the planes the number one thing to be beaten down within the 9/11 research and so-called truth movements? Why? Because they need, meaning the perps and their aiders and abettors, they need Arab hijackers. Why do they need them? Because this is their whole story about a terrorist attack, a Pearl Harbor attack by foreigners on the homeland, and then that gives them the pretext for the war on the Muslim world. That's putting it more honestly than saying a war on terror.
No planes, no hijackers, no hijackers, no Muslims, no war.
If we prove no commercial airliners, there can't be any hijackers driving these.
The whole business about the planes is so enveloped in mystery. Like, two of these planes were only deregistered with the FAA in 2002, two others not until 2005.
Right. And where's the record on the hull insurance paid on any of these four aircraft? There are only a handful of insurance companies who insure commercial aircraft. There's not a whit of proof that anybody paid off American Airlines or United Airlines. American and United are complicit. I would right away, of course, I would arrest the CEOs at the time of UA. You know, they were in my top 36 to arrest.
Well, okay. So the list of 19 alleged phone callers, persons who are supposed to have made phone calls from these planes, and in relation to the Social Security Death Index, only one of those 19 is listed as deceased, and in relation to a survivor's fund for the families to benefit, none have collected any money. That's very peculiar.
Right. I believe that these planes allegedly only had one-quarter average occupancy.
Right.
And the passenger manifests don't check out. Of course, nothing checks out. But I emphasize, number one, the physical impossibility of these crashes, as officially claimed.
Do we want to start maybe in Shanksville or the Pentagon and work our way back to the Trade Center?
Okay. Let's... because those are less controversial.
Yes.
Once we can get people in the mood here, we can carry them all the way, perhaps. But, yeah, the Pentagon is the one that is people are most skeptical about. A lot of us believe that we can prove that no Boeing 757 went in there, into the Pentagon. And the physical evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of whatever hit the Pentagon. It certainly wasn't so-called Flight 77.
Yeah, it was no Boeing 757. I'm convinced of this, Morgan. It was the Pentagon that got me first hooked on this case. And in some photo studies by Jack White, but also those two books by Thierry Meiss and Pentagate and 9/11, The Big Lie.
Right, Hunt the Boeing.
Which was the website that his son put it together.
Right, how could a Boeing 757, which is a very large aircraft, it's a 200-passenger aircraft, how could it fit through this hole that was less, the first 20 minutes of the event was less than 20 feet in diameter?
Yeah, the ground, it's on the ground floor, it's only about 10 feet high and 16 or 17 feet wide. That plane weighs 100 tons, has a 125-foot wingspan, it has a tail that stands 44 feet above the ground, and you find no massive residue of debris. You don't find the wings, you don't find the seats, the luggage, the bodies, not even the tail, one of the structurally strongest parts of aircraft. Not even the engines were recovered, Morgan, and they're all but indestructible.
It's ridiculous, and
And, you know, they show you this little piece of aluminum foil that's painted red, white, and blue, and we're supposed to believe it.
Jack observed that they moved it around and photographed it from different locations. I guess that meant we had even more evidence. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. I wish I could say it's going to be all right. I think, Morgan, one of the reasons why the issue at the Pentagon has become so hotly contested by those who are, in this regard, functioning as apologists for the government is that it's such a glaring inadequacy, refutation of the government's account if there were no Boeing 757. And yet the evidence of the absence of a Boeing is overwhelming, including, of course, the videotape where the Pentagon reluctantly released initially five frames and did it indirectly, I'm convinced, so they could deny that they were authentic in case anything unexpected showed up in them. Only one of the frames shows, you know, something that could possibly be the outline of an aircraft, or at least part of the tail, and they conveniently label it in the lower right-hand corner. Plane. If you take a Boeing 757 silhouette and compare it, or diagram and compare it, you know, size it to the size of that tail, it extends twice as far out behind the parking mechanism as you have there. That plane is 155 feet long. It's more than twice as long as the Pentagon at 77 feet is high. It would be clearly visible in those videos if the plane were there. It is not visible because the plane is not there. Even Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor, when he played one of these videos, was embarrassed and chagrined to admit that he couldn't see the plane after assuring his audience that this video was going to lay all these issues to rest.
Yeah, why is the government withholding some 80 tapes?
We estimate there are 84, and they've released three, and none of them is any more informative than that single frame.
And a Boeing 757 has about 3 million parts. And we know what air accident, what air crashes look like. They spread stuff for a couple of city blocks at least when they slam into something. And there are bodies, there's blood, there's luggage, there's purses and lipstick and mail. And where is all that stuff?
I know it. Yeah, and as Colonel George Nelson, a retired Air Force expert on crash investigations, has observed, those planes have hundreds and hundreds, possibly thousands, of time-sensitive, uniquely identified parts, and not one of those uniquely identifiable parts has ever been produced for any of those four alleged aircraft.
Yeah, I think I know why there was no official. The FBI hasn't said as much, but actually Colonel Nelson put in a FOIA request.
Yes.
And they wouldn't admit that it was the FBI's responsibility to do air accident or air crash investigation. And they wouldn't say whether or not they'd done one. Well, there's almost nothing to investigate except a few planted parts in New York. And they didn't have the courtesy, really, to plant all that much in Shanksville.
So the Shanksville thing is quite ridiculous. But just to make one further argument about it turns out this trajectory of this huge plane barely skimming above the ground and coming in about 500 miles an hour to hit on the ground floor turns out not even to be aerodynamically possible. I've discussed it with aeronautical engineers and pilots, and it turns out that any plane in flight, you know, it builds up a packet of compressed gas beneath the fuselage such that even a Cessna, a little Cessna at full throttle, couldn't get closer than 15 feet to the ground. The estimates I've received is that big plane at 500 miles an hour couldn't have got closer than 60 feet to the ground. And, of course, if it were actually skimming the ground, we all know the wake of a jet blast, a jet engine will, you know, is powerful enough to turn automobiles over. It would have just caused massive turbulence and destruction to the lawn. And there's this phenomenon known as wake turbulence from planes in the air that has been known to rip tiles off of rooftops even at normal cruising altitude. So that lawn would have been a total mess. In fact, it's clear, smooth, and green as a putting surface. I expect Tiger Woods to show up with his caddy.
Mm-hmm. In his Buick, of course. He wouldn't use a Lexus. But, yeah, there's. If you go to drjudywood.com, we've got a, under her news item, just click on we have some holes in the plane stories. I've got a very thorough analysis, I think, of the Pentagon. all the facts refute the government theory. Also an article called No Big Boeing Theory. And then if we move off to the Pennsylvania event, oh, by the way, of course, this Flight 77 supposedly wandered around the eastern part of the country for 40 minutes after the second hit at the World Trade Center, and they didn't put up a combat air patrol over the nation's capital. They tell us these stories about in the terror timeline, Paul Thompson points out that they don't even put down a flight path for the last alleged 20 minutes of Flight 77. Nothing works in behalf of the official story on the Pentagon. Then if we go to Pennsylvania, of course, this is absolutely absurd, what they claim about the struggle with the hijackers and then a vertical crash. They show us this little hole is all it is. It's 20 feet wide, about maybe 10 feet, or pardon me, long. It's 20 feet long. It's got these wing imprints. No wings, of course. This is at the a landfill where it's the deep part of the quarry that they've filled in. And it's no more than 10 feet deep. And as the first person there, Nina Lenzbauer, said, hey, this is smaller than the 24-foot trailer in her yard.
Well, George Nelson described it to me. He said it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up.
Yeah, right. That seems like a plausible theory. They just put some ordnance with some trash in there.
You wouldn't know this, Morgan, but I had residents of the area call me to tell me. They told the FBI they heard an explosion in the air before they heard any impact with the ground. The FBI wouldn't even write it down. I had a woman write to me and say how she was taken to a search area far outside the officially designated crash zone by deputy sheriffs to look for body parts and aircraft debris, and was told that if she mentioned this to anyone, the sheriffs would deny it. I know personally a former inspector general for the Air Force who used to be responsible for air crash investigations, who told me if it had actually crashed the way it was alleged, that its debris should have covered about one city block. In fact, there are claims of debris that over 8 square miles.
Oh, yeah, and we don't know if that's valid or not, although there are reports to that effect.
I found early reports, two of which I frequently play now, of reporters on the scene who are saying how there is just no evidence of a plane. They don't see any plane there.
There's nothing
bigger.
You see
little wispy pieces of stuff
bigger than
there, but it doesn't seem to have any connection to aircraft.
Right, and where's 5,000 gallons of jet fuel? There was grass growing right along that hole.
And the alleged photograph of the smoke cloud is a little wimpy thing that looks like it came from very modest demolition, not from any jet plane crash. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder Hears on Fridays and Mondays, and I'm here the rest of the week today with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, who's going to help us to figure out what happened at the World Trade Center vis-a-vis these planes. Morgan, I agree that there's so much chicanery going on here. Even that dark billowing smoke from in front of the Pentagon turns out to be coming from a series of dumpsters. I had a fellow come through Duluth who showed me 44 more frames that confirmed what I'd already independently concluded from a series of photographs I had available to me, and you could see clear space between the dumpsters and the building, and the smoke was coming up to create this psychological effect on the members of Congress as they came pouring out of the Capitol building. I think it was indispensable for the psychological impact. If you looked over there and you didn't see much, you'd think not much has gone on, so you got to have this prop, a special effect that the Pentagon, I think, is as clear-cut as it could possibly be. So tell us how you think these things played out at the World Trade Center.
Hey, they kept those smudge pots going for another couple of days. I remember taking the metro across the Potomac River, and they certainly had it going the next day. They had smoke wafting up and everybody, psychological effect.
About it was just
how they attacked us right at the center of our military. You know, we're going to go after them. But listen to this. You're a man who likes consistency. And if you compare these four alleged commercial airliner crashes, we are to believe that, for example, no wing imprints were made on the exterior ring, the E-ring at the Pentagon.
Right. And that's limestone, too, Morgan.
And Yeah, and
relatively soft stone.
And yet, and then we're supposed to believe these cutouts in the towers were made by commercial airliners. In other words, they were able to allegedly make these realistic, we'll call it for the moment, airplane shapes. But then in the soft dirt here, in a quarry landfill, all they could do was have this lame shape only 20 feet long, and that's supposed to be a wing imprint, and the plane disappeared down there.
Morgan, do you know I've heard the absurdity that the plane just happened to fly right into a mine shaft?
Oh, yeah. They had it. Well, here's Judy Wood had a student who lived right in that county, in that town. And he said, oh, gee, on September 11th, 2001, he said, it's a good thing it crashed there because nobody would get hurt. Nobody lives right there. And, of course, what Judy thought automatically is, of course, that's where they'd stage it. There were no eyewitness reports of a plane crash.
It's supposed to have gone down a mine shaft. We know how to go into mine shafts to rescue miners. You think we wouldn't go into a mine shaft to rescue that, what, 60, 80 or whatever passengers and all that, figure out what
but
happened?
We all know.
Retrieve their bodies?
There's no
certainly
plane.
Didn't see any excavation going on there, Morgan.
We know there's no plane there by virtue of the 20-foot-wide nature of this hole and all the other evidence of this hole. So whether or not there was a plane or whether it was shot down and all that other stuff is another story, but don't sell me the Shanksville hole. It's absurd.
Now, the fact that Jeff King, for example, is expressing doubts about the way in which the planes allegedly, the South Tower in particular, the plane allegedly hit the South Tower, seems to me to be a really strong reason for rethinking what we may have thought we knew about it. But let me just sketch a couple of concerns that I have seen. When I was in Chandler, Dave Von Kleist, who produced, of course, In Plain Sight, and received a mountain of flack for talking about the irregular features on the plane and this flash that seems to occur just as it's contacting the building, showed four different perspectives on exactly the same moment when that flash is taking place. Now, if planes didn't hit the building, then it looks as though there's been quite a bit of ingenuity exercise in coming up with quite a large number of different photographs and films about it. And so I think part of the incredulity that is this very hypothesis receives from scratch is the belief that there must be an awful lot of photos and films around, that if this was staged or fake, then it has to have been tightly controlled with regard to that large variety of photos and films. And I just how do you cope with that complaint?
Well, this is kind of third-order type issue, but on 9/11 hoax, I will address it. 9/11hoax.com, there's one coalition of how many, you ask how many films, supposedly there's 37. I mean, I don't think anybody has an exact count. Supposedly 16 photos, and then he has miscellaneous, another miscellaneous 15.
Good.
So, there's a lot of these around, and then the question is, are any of these genuine, are there inconsistencies, etc.?
That's right.
Actually, if you think about it, Jim, it's suspicious that there are, it seems like an organized effort to supply so many of these videos to support the plane crash hypothesis, because what was going on when this hit allegedly occurred at 9:03? Well, the North Tower was ablaze up in the top, right? Smoking like crazy. So people would have certainly focused on that. But how many with cameras would have focused on the south face of the South Tower? If they did, they would have done their best to get over and take a look at the North Tower.
Now, my wife reminded me, Morgan, we were talking about this, that we were actually watching when the South Tower hit. But, of course, what she's talking about, we were watching television. And I think just as in the case of the reporter reporting that Building 7 had already collapsed, except in this case we could see over her shoulder, it had not. I take it you're suggesting that the film may have been pre-prepared to be played on television?
Well, they had the ability to insert a fake image. And besides, of course, they had years to do this. But you ask, for example, well, are there video or is there video or TV coverage that showed an explosion, this pyrotechnic display, a Hollywood style, in the South Tower without a plane. And if you go to drjudywood.com, drjudywood.com, go to news, she's got up this item from livevideo.com, which from Octopus, that shows side by side the Chopper 4, the NBC affiliate coverage, where there is no plane and all of a sudden there's an explosion. Meanwhile, at the same time, WB, with a camera that's not in a chopper, that's Channel 11, shows this plane image, which looks fake to me, but maybe I'm biased, and going in, and then an explosion. And then there's another piece of this footage where they actually exploded it early. They have a plane coming in, hip-hopping along. And it's not the right timing because you can still see the plane hasn't, quote, hit the building, and then there's this explosion. So what you have in video is an awful lot of fakery out there. They can't all be right now, could they? Just the three I told you about. And you can see, let's see, what is it? It's about 9 minutes, I think, of this live video coverage that lays a couple of these TV broadcasts side by side. So, really, this is all second or third order to me, but it's important.
It's a stunning idea, you know, I mean, when we're actually watching something on television seemingly live, to suppose we could be so, you know, faked out of our jocks like this. I mean, I'm looking at that image on the web page, figure 22A, the silhouette of passage by the... by the Invincible, as you're describing, a Boeing 767. And I know you have these, you know, some wonderful arguments, Morgan, and it's just so damn difficult psychologically for anyone to open their mind to the possibility that a magnitude involved in this particular event could be taking place. We'll be right back. Today with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, we're discussing controversial aspects of 9/11, research on 9/11. And Morgan, I'm just... fascinated by all of this. I mean, heretofore, you know, I have contemplated that probably there was, a substitution in the planes. I've speculated they were probably military versions of 767s that were larger, carried jet fuel, you know, more jet fuel for a more spectacular fireball. Now, the question I think that may be in the minds of others listening to us discuss this is, what is the benefit from not using planes? You know, wouldn't it be simpler to just use planes for this part? I mean, granted, it's purely a psych-op, and the jet fuel is just a distraction, a spectacular distraction. Why not do it that way?
The short answer is KISS. They wanted to keep it simple. This is actually simpler. There's too much of a chance that things can go wrong trying to crash these four buildings in the right way. And there's too many people that can pick up a part. They're going to find out. It can, for example, the plane can crash in the wrong place. That would be a disaster. That would expose the whole thing right there, and you're done. This way, they can cover up a lot of things because they have the control of the mainstream media. That's the real secret here. But for whatever reason, they chose to do it this way with no planes. Because I can prove beyond any doubt that the physics don't... For example, a plane does not melt into a steel concrete building like the video show. And when some of these frames on the CNN thing show that the wing between the engine and the fuselage has disappeared in the building, but there's no gash there. And when the right wing goes into the building, of course, there's no line there. In fact, the whole building heals itself up before these explosions start. In other words, this is preposterous. Of course, the holes are undersized. There is no airplane debris below the impact zone. There's none in either gash. Everybody would agree with that. Where the heck are the plane parts? And then we're to believe that this invincible type plane went through this undersized hole and then became ultra fragile and went to confetti and all stopped within 208 feet with no tail showing, on and on. And I'm going, what? The physics and the debris evidence doesn't fit the story you're telling me at all. And in fact, you know, we have actually, you remember Lisa Giuliani with Victor Thorne of Wing TV, who now disappeared from the scene, but she coined the phrase, we have the four cleanest crash sites in aviation history.
I like that, Morgan. I like that.
That sums it up. So anybody, any reasonable person has got to entertain the idea that you've been fooled big time here.
Well, I'm willing to believe that, given how much we have been fooled in the BBC footage, and I gather that Judy has now uncovered some footage where you get four different stations simultaneously reading the same script at the same time. That's pretty stunning stuff. I mean, I'm willing to believe that we have been deceived in all kinds of ways. And I got to say, what you're doing here is to me utterly fascinating. I mean, I can't tell you that at this point in time I'm convinced by this, but I can tell you that I certainly have my mind ajar, and I'm bothered enough by the reports that you have and the evidence you and Judy have amassed and the arguments you've given, which, of course, are extremely interesting and challenging enough that I included a chapter by you about the plane stories in the book that is I've edited this forthcoming, The 9/11 Conspiracy. And I think that it's a valuable contribution, Morgan, because it makes us think more deeply about all these issues, and that you write terribly well. Your arguments are very good. Integrating it with the photographic evidence is what has to take place in my mind for me, you know, to find it persuasive. But I'll tell you, it's fascinating stuff, and there's so much that is ridiculous about 9/11. In some very broad sense, that the whole thing had been a smoke and mirrors, with a lot of smoke in this case, could not be just ruled out. It couldn't be just, you know, wildly implausible.
I wanted to tell you a story here where Dave Von Kleist, you mentioned, and his video in plain sight.
Right.
I was on the same stage with he and Eric Hufschmidt, et cetera. This is back in the good old days, you might say, December 05, when Jimmy Walter put together a little couple shows down in Florida. And I didn't get a chance to answer, but somebody asked me, you know, because Von Kleist is all worried about this pod, or bulge and the flash.
Right.
And I said, well, why are you worried about that? I didn't get a chance to be divisive here, but this plane picture doesn't even have the right livery for United Airlines 175, right? It doesn't have the dark blue under fuselage and the gray. It had the aluminum look of an American Airlines image. You know, the whole thing is ridiculous. It's like analyzing a Roadrunner cartoon to find the secret of life.
Well, you know, I mean, this is ironic. As I'm putting together, as you know, a conference on the you know, the controversial aspects of 9/11 for August the 2nd through the 4th, and because you're doing all this work on the planes, that we want to go into in great detail about all four sites. All three sites with all four planes, and because Dave Kleist was given a presentation where he had, you know, all four different images at the very moment the plane is about to hit the building, I was trying to feel him out to see whether he'd like to come and be like a commentator or discuss these things with you. I know this is the first you're hearing of it from me.
Well, that's all right. Yeah,
I have the feeling he may be very hesitant to do this for all kinds of reasons.
Well, maybe the video sales would plummet.
I don't know. But, I mean, you know, it seemed to me he's one who has a very strong interest in this issue of necessity, given how much he's been beat up about it and how much he's invested in it. His stuff looked really good to me, so I would be kind of fascinated to get you guys together to talk about it.
Maybe he wants to defend the pro-plane point of view.
That was part of it, you know, because
right.
What I want is to get a real mix here so that we can really try to thrash these things out. It's extremely interesting, Morgan, what you're coming up with here, and I just want to say that I think it's well worth looking at the evidence you have put together. We're so used to watching movies and television that we have become very uncritical about what we see, I'm afraid, that we no longer really become very careful or cautious about being taken in by visual effects.
That goes back to the point that people have got to think for themselves. We think we know what's real and not real in terms of these effects because we trust them to tell us. You know, so the a movie with special effects, okay, we know it's not true, but we're willing to float along and be entertained. But when we watch the news, supposedly none of that's fake. But, of course, as we earlier referred to the BBC report in front of the World Trade Center, oh, it collapsed, but it's still there at 4:57 p.m. right in the picture.
Yeah, astounding. I think maybe the reason these three issues have become so controversial, the planes, no planes, at the World Trade Center, the mode of destruction of the World Trade Center, and the absence, evidence for the absence of a 757 at the Pentagon is because proof of any of those, that it was a high-tech weapon, for example, so directly implicates the government. If this was some
right.
kind of laser, major, plastic, whatever, it has to have been the government. There's no way any
right.
other source could possibly explain it. So I think even on if you can buy thermite on eBay, for example, then even if thermite were involved, it doesn't directly implicate the government. It leaves a remaining link to be established. But that's not the case if, in fact, it were some kind of high-tech weapon of which only the military has access.
Right. And the other leading governments take G8. Of course, they all know this, and some may have participated, but they're complicit.
I can't thank you enough for coming on, Morgan Reynolds. I don't know if we've answered all the questions, but you sure raised some good ones, and I'm just delighted to have you here. We'll have to do it again. I want to thank my guests, and I want to thank all of you for listening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo.